Following Up is our new Without Borders podcast series, where we explore the world of media through the eyes of journalists. Join us as we deep dive into journalists' careers, uncover their daily working lives, the priorities and challenges they're facing, and how they're adapting to today's changing media landscape. Each episode, the media specialists at Taito are putting journalists in the hot seat and delving into the topics and stories that they really care about and getting the inside scoop on best practice for media relations.
Hello and welcome to the second episode of Following Up. In this series, we interview some of Europe's most respected tech journalists to get to know them better and understand their vision of the media industry. In today's episode, we're joined by Thomas McCauley, senior reporter at The Next Web, a publication that covers technology and startups in Europe. Thomas has been working as a journalist since 2013, and in his current role, he focuses on Europe's tech ecosystem, deep tech, startups, and government policy. I'm Sophie. I specialize in UK media relations at Taito.
And I'm Bastian, a German media specialist at Taito.
Welcome to the podcast, Thomas.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Lovely to have you. So firstly, if you could please give us a quick overview of The Next Web and the publication's focus areas and what kind of audience you've got.
Sure. So The Next Web is based in the Netherlands. I'm usually based in London. The company is owned by the Financial Times, and there's sort of four main arms to the business. Media, which is obviously where I work, and then we also have an events arm, which includes our flagship conference in June, Spaces, which is co-working services, and Programs, which is a tech consultancy service, essentially. And yeah, and then the media team, it covers European tech with a particular focus on startups. And our audience is quite broad. We used to be much more of a worldwide audience and team, but now we're much more focused on Europe, both general readers and particularly people who work in the tech sector.
Brilliant. And can you give us a typical day in your life and sort of what your day-to-day is like as a senior reporter?
Sure. So my week every day is either a feature day or a news day. It's split in half. So 2 days a week I'll be doing features, and then 2 or 3 days a week I'll be doing news. We have an editorial meeting every morning where we discuss our day's coverage. A lot of that will already have been planned ahead as much as possible. So, you know, we might have features that are scheduled to go out that day, or maybe some embargoed news stories that we were also scheduled to publish. And then there'll also be sort of more breaking news from the world of tech that we will allocate to specific journalists on that day. And yeah, after that meeting, I'll sort of, yeah, my day's a mix of, you know, interviews, writing stories, a lot of reading of research and reports, and emailing sources, which will often include people in the world of PR.
Excellent. So when it comes to features and stories that you're writing, what would make a company or a expert spokesperson really compelling to feature? Are there any specific criteria you look for, or any qualities in a spokesperson that stand out?
Yeah, I love that question because it can sometimes make or break a story. I'd say just in general, someone who's concise, articulate, and revealing, most importantly. I mean, obviously, company representatives have to toe the company line at times, but if they can offer something a little bit beyond the kind of boilerplate promotional sort of stuff, that's always much more interesting for us. Their role can also be important. They will, you know, will add weight to what they're saying if they're a company executive, for example, or a founder. But the most important thing is what they say, I'd say. So someone who's interesting and quotable.
So a bit more about you. You've had quite a diverse career. So from being a postal clerk to teaching journalism, did you have a moment or a realization in the past that led you to become a journalist?
It was actually an ambition I had when I was back at school, but life got in the way, and you know, I did do bits of writing in previous roles. I worked for the National Health Service in the UK for several years, and I would do writing for their newsletters and things like that. But it was really only in my late 20s that I pursued it seriously. I'd moved to Barcelona, which is where my then girlfriend was from. She wanted to be back, and I joined her. And I think something about that change of scene kind of gave me a new perspective and really a new focus on what I wanted to do in my career. And so I initially started writing for a magazine there. It was like a sort of a guide to the city for expats. And it was all in print, which is quite fun and increasingly unusual. And then from there, I eventually applied for a master's degree in journalism in London, which I came back to. And that from there went straight into doing tech journalism. Pretty much, so there was a little bit of a gap in between. I was doing some shifts at the Independent for a while and bits and bobs, but the first sort of full-time job I had in journalism was tech journalism.
And speaking of Barcelona, how is Europe's tech landscape unique when compared to the rest of the world? Is there anything that sets it apart?
Yeah, a few things. I think Europe's got great research, you know, particularly from the universities. And I cover the UK primarily, and we have famously the Golden Triangle of Oxford, Cambridge, and the London universities. There's a huge amount of talent and some great, yeah, research going on there. Probably not so good at converting that research into world-leading companies. One other thing that stands out about the EU globally is the regulatory regime. We see more and more of EU regulations around AI, or going back to GDPR, and now the sort of Digital Services Act. And those are sort of setting standards globally, partly because even the big tech firms in Silicon Valley have to follow a lot of the rules.
And I think you might have partially answered this question already, but so your reporting interests primarily lie in deep tech startups and government policy. Could you tell us a bit more about why these areas particularly interest you and what you find most interesting about covering them?
Sure. For deep tech and startups, both of them, I'd say it's the breakthroughs. There's so many exciting ideas that come out and that might not go mainstream for years, if at all, you know, when a big company actually puts them to the market, to a mass market even. But yeah, I find it's fascinating to sort of be constantly discovering all of these potentially transformative and sometimes quite sci-fi concepts before they go mainstream. Government policy, very different. I think it's the impact that it has on ordinary people's lives, both positive and negative. And as I said, because the EU has become such a sort of a world leader in regulation, it's a great time to be covering it.
Speaking of the stories that you've covered, is there sort of something you've got in your mind as the most interesting story or the biggest story you've ever covered or worked on? And why was it so interesting?
Yeah, I guess sort of biggest is quite subjective. You know, it depends whether you mean like the impact or the amount of people that read it, or like ones that I've personally found most interesting. It's one that we broke a few years ago that was quite significant was the release of GPT-2, which is the OpenAI large language model that sort of was a big driving force behind the generative AI explosion today. But I have to admit, I wasn't very happy with that story. I don't think we did a very good job covering it. I don't think I did a very good job covering it, but other publications that picked it up later did a much better job, I would say. But I'm personally much more interested in features than news. It's sort of hard to pick one out because I quite quickly move on to the next one once one has been published. But I guess the most recent one that I found really interesting was a piece we published last week about the emergence of this anti-disinformation industry in Ukraine specifically, which has been driven by the conflict in Russia and there's this kind of thriving but quite nascent ecosystem of startups that are developing tools around countering disinformation, which is quite a politically controversial subject in itself. But that's the most recent piece that I've got really into.
When you're working on a bigger feature like that, how important are things like research and statistics and data, and also what kind of sources do you look to for that type of thing?
Yeah, it's incredibly important. It can be the foundation of a story, or it can just add something that's sort of more objective that can prove a point more effectively. But it really varies. The specifics vary from story to story. So if we're covering a more business focused piece, then you know financial figures will be really important. I would say it's a crucial element of most of the reporting we do.
And away from your writing part of your role, Do you attend any industry events on a regular basis every year? And are there any that you also choose not to, and you just avoid them every year?
Sure. I do attend quite a lot. Obviously, the one that I have to attend every year for sort of, the essential one is our own conference, TNW conference, which is every June. And other than that, it really depends on the agenda and our own availability. You know, I don't think there's sort of one that I would consider a must attend. And similarly, there aren't any that I would just say an absolute no to. But maybe the more, because we now focus more on European tech, if it's like a US focused event, then those aren't really right for us, of which there are loads. But as I said, it's all about the agenda, the speakers that are there, and the, you know, the potential news that can come of it. So it's hard to really know in advance.
What do you think of vendor events, many tech companies are doing regularly? Like just recently there was the Salesforce Dreamforce, for example. Are you open to visit them?
Yeah, open to. As the example you gave of Salesforce, again, because it's a US company and it's less likely that we'd attend that unless there's a really strong European angle, be it some kind of collaboration they're doing with a European company or something that really targets European customers. But I think that's generally rare that there would be enough of a European focus for us to attend. Other company conferences in Europe, we do attend occasionally. Although I'd say for the most part, we prefer the events where there's a sort of a broader selection of speakers and companies, because there's more stories potentially for us.
Yeah, of course.
And when you're interviewing sort of sources for various things, is there any particular figure from the tech or startup world that you'd love to interview? Anyone at all?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, there are loads. For some reason, the first person that springs to mind is Peter Thiel, but there's this mystique and general weirdness about him and like a sort of super villain quality that I find quite fascinating. And he doesn't do a lot of interviews as well, which makes it even more intriguing. I think also I'd love to interview Sam Bankman-Fried about the collapse of FTX, because I think there are still so many unanswered questions about that. And like a lot of sort of general whistleblowers in generally, I find really interesting. Obviously, Francis Haugen from the Facebook papers is a good one. I think that sort of stands out to me. I guess Edward Snowden as well. So people in that sort of world of whistleblowing, I always find pretty intriguing.
Is that something you've done to date? Have you kind of been someone that someone who's a whistleblower speaks to?
I wish I could say yes, but it's rarely happened. It's more. The closest thing to that, we speak a lot to researchers who, you know, are investigating the potential harms caused by technology. I've spoken to a lot of AI researchers about biases in AI, amplifying racial stereotypes or gender stereotypes, etc. And, you know, people who have sort of spotted risks in some of these enormous AI systems that are becoming increasingly entwined in our lives. So I speak to a lot of people like that, and occasionally like people have actually been victims of some of the outcomes. But people, whistleblowers, I think generally they tend to go to the really, really big media outlets and the mainstream ones before they come to more niche tech publications. But yeah, I wish I could say yes, I speak to loads of them. It doesn't really happen so far.
I guess you're interested in the story behind the story, right, of the whistleblowing. So you approach them afterwards as well.
Yeah, exactly. And on that subject, I think they're much more likely to speak to a broader selection of media once they've blown the whistle, you know, for follow-up stories. But we would rarely, in fact, I don't think we've ever really been the first port of call for any whistleblowers.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, you also need like a lot of resources for it, right, for a bigger story.
Yeah,
like exactly. Investigation team.
Yeah.
Cool. Next, we would like to talk with you about PR. So first, we've been wondering, like everyone has an idea how journalism works, but even PR professionals and their clients often have misconceptions. And so we've been wondering, what is something you would like them to know about the role of a journalist?
Yeah, I guess it's hard to generalize a bit because my experiences with PR workers have been so varied. Some are clearly very knowledgeable about the work and some really have no idea. But I think the worst experiences tend to be when they either don't recognize what your job involves in terms of what you're covering. So I get a lot of pitches that are totally irrelevant, and then consecutive follow-up emails, which can be quite time consuming to deal with. And I suppose it's the ones who don't know what your specific interests are. I think that's much more understandable. Obviously, they're contacting loads of journalists every day, but when they have clearly made an effort to really find out who you are, what you're interested in, what stories you cover, that makes a huge difference. So I think, if they've done that, I'm much more interested in speaking to them and hearing what they have to say.
Roughly, like, how many emails do you receive each day from PR people?
It varies, but nowadays, I mean, easily can get like 50 a day.
And how many of them do you think are relevant for you?
The 10%, if I'm lucky, probably less. I think we seem to get a little bit less now, but there have been times when we had more of a kind of, because we changed our strategy quite recently to focus entirely on Europe. When we were more global, I could easily get 100 a day, and I'd be lucky I'd be lucky if sort of two or three of those were relevant. Now it's much, much better, which is great because it suggests that there's a greater understanding of what we're doing now. And there was probably a transitional period when no one really understood, but now I get a lot more startup focused, Europe tech focused. So it's actually improved a lot in the last few months.
Yeah, I see. It makes sense. Like if you more communicate what you do, then you also get the right input. But how do you filter your inbox if you have like 50 emails a day? I guess you don't read all of them.
No, I mean, a lot of them I will just archive when I can see even the top line, because you can tell sometimes straight away. The ones that are relevant, I try to reply to. And obviously, if it's something we're interested in covering, I'll obviously reply to those. But it does take a huge amount of time to go through all those emails. And I guess that's one thing I would probably say to PRs as well, if they not to feel too upset if they're not getting replies, because if we replied to every single email, it would be literally the entire day's work.
Of course, and also I can totally relate. If you reply, then oftentimes you get yet another email, and which doesn't make it easier. Like, just adds to it. I don't. Many of our clients have like a golden circle of key journalists that are the most important for them. And we've been wondering if there's something like an equivalent on your side. Is there a group of trusted PR professionals or the companies they work for that you regularly reach out to?
Yeah, definitely. It tends to be more on an individual basis rather than a company basis. I mean, there are definitely PR companies that I have a better opinion of. You know, and Taito, honestly, is one of them, which is why I was happy to do this podcast. But in the vast majority of cases, it's the individual PR person who I will have had good interactions with, sort of know them vaguely on a personal level, and they consistently send me relevant and interesting stories. And I will both reach out for them if I need a source for a story that I think they could help with. And I'll also be much more interested in opening their emails and sort of, spending more time actually seeing if there's something worth developing from that.
Yeah, it's yet another filter you probably use, of course. And is there a very smart way a PR expert has ever approached you that sticks to your mind, that comes to your mind?
Yeah, there's been a few. I think one that really always sticks out to me, because he was great, the former Facebook PR who was responsible for their AI team. He was I think he's left now, unfortunately, but he, when he first reached out to me, he offered an interview with their head of AI. He's a kind of globally recognized leader of the field. And, that was his first email to me. It was an offer of an interview with this guy. So that was a very good first impression. I did the interview, and then he would consistently send me really interesting stuff after that. I think in general, that's what is ideal for me. When it's when they're sending something that's quite unique, be it an offer of an interview with someone who's renowned in their field, or if it's an exclusive or something embargoed, or even just a really good story idea. And yeah, a well-crafted pitch can help as well. Sometimes you just get a really well-written pitch. And even if the actual content of that isn't that relevant, when it's really well-written, that definitely catches my eye as well.
Nice. And do you have an example of a really poor pitch that you have received and why it didn't work?
I think, to be frank, the majority of the pitches are pretty poor. There aren't really any that stick out, because what makes a pitch poor for me is it's all about the irrelevance of it, really. Recently I've been getting, for some reason, loads of pitches from some influencer agency, and they're totally irrelevant. But it's what did they send me the other day? Something about some fitness grandma who had a supernatural experience in Bosnia. But I actually quite enjoy receiving those pictures, so I haven't unsubscribed, blocked them. But it's the ones that, the bad ones are the ones that are particularly irrelevant, I guess.
That doesn't help to be clickbaity when drafting a pitch
to get attention? No, not at all. No, I think, I guess, you know, like our audience, I'm probably susceptible to a good bit of clickbait, but the top line and the heading, the subject of the email is the most important thing. That, you know, you have to be, as I said, because we've seen so many, I have to be like quite instantly caught by it, rather than, you know, having to read through a long email to find out whether it's interesting.
Of course. And when is the best time to reach you? Like, when do you read your emails?
Every morning, it's one of the first things I do. So it's good, even if it's something that was sent overnight, that's great. If it's in the middle of the day, there's a good chance I won't catch it till either late in the day or even the next morning. I think I'm also, I mean, maybe this is a little bit tangential, but when we receive any kind of embargoed news, it's great to get a bit of notice. Often find that if it, even with an embargoed piece, it might only be the next day the embargo lifts. And we like to do follow-up questions in general. So if there's only, you know, if it's only overnight that when the embargo's therefore, then we might not have time to do that before the embargo lifts. So it's really great if we could get at least a few days. It also allows us to organize our scheduling a bit.
Of course. And how long does it take you to put together a story, like a feature and also a news?
Yeah, that's really hard to answer because it varies so much. I've written news stories in under an hour, and I spent like an entire week writing a feature. But a news story would be, I can't really answer that. The features, I would say, generally take at least a day, and news stories would always take less than a day.
Yeah, of course. Highly depends. At the moment, obviously, everyone is talking about AI. Is there a specific story or topic that you believe deserves more attention?
Yeah, great question. I think from a personal perspective, something that I find fascinating and don't see much coverage of is genomics. That might be because it's quite slow moving. I'm being a bit presumptuous here because I'm not an expert on it at all. But I think quantum computing as well, but there's a good reason why there isn't that much coverage of it, because it hasn't actually yielded functioning applications yet. But it sort of seems like a matter of time before that is really a transformative technology. It's also incredibly complicated, which is why I think a lot of journalists, including me, are somewhat reluctant to cover it. But yeah, those are the first two that spring to mind, genomics and quantum computing.
Is there also a topic you wish you would never have to hear or write about again?
Yeah, right now I would definitely say Web3. Maybe it'll produce some useful applications one day, but all the pitches I've received, they seem to be essentially crypto schemes masquerading as some sort of, you know, revolution in decentralization. Obviously that peaked during the crypto boom of just a couple of years ago now, or a year ago now. But I still receive loads of pitches for those, and I just basically ignore all of them.
When it comes to writing about these very in-depth, very, very techie topics, as someone who's not sort of deep in that industry, how do you go about familiarizing yourself with something like genomics, for example, if you know nothing about it and then you suddenly get a pitch about it? How do you go about kind of getting that baseline understanding of it?
Sure. I'd say the two main ways. One is speaking to people who really do know what they're talking about. So, you know, I've got sometimes people I speak to regularly, others that I'll just reach out to, but maybe they'll contact me. And you'll want to read quite a lot of research papers, especially preprint ones, which can be sometimes quite tough to get your head around. But they can provide that kind of basis in the science. So I'd say that's a combination too, just reading a lot of and you know, some sort of more like business style reports about, you know, maybe some analyst firms like Gartner. I'll read some stuff by those to just sort of get a bit more familiarity about where industry experts see the sector going.
It's funny that you just mentioned the two most scientific topics that are around in tech almost.
The
one you would like to read more about.
No, absolutely. Again, that's probably why I find deep tech pretty fascinating. I don't have a very scientific mind either, but I think, you know, that's kind of what journalists have to do, you know, translating this quite complicated stuff into language that regular people can understand.
Cool. We're coming to an end. So our last question is, how do you see the relationship between tech, government and media evolving over the next few years?
Sure. A big topic. Do you mean the relationship between media and government and tech?
Yes, exactly. And if there are like any specific challenges that you see or that you expect to see and opportunities?
Yeah, I think one big issue, and it's a growing issue, I think, is that journalists, you know, they really rely on access to the companies or the governments as well that they cover, which can sort of make them reluctant to do adversarial journalism, you know, because if you're too critical of these companies or governments, then they're not going to give you much access anymore. I think that's becoming a bigger problem, partly because companies and governments as well, they can be a bit more selective about who they communicate with and what they reveal. And they probably more and more wonder what the value is sometimes of reaching out to media. I think like a prime example, we don't cover them too much now, though, is Apple, who like very, very hard to get any kind of spokespeople to talk to. And now we've seen similarly at Twitter, or now X, they've kind of, you know, demolished their PR department and it's impossible to really speak to anyone there. On the more positive side, I think there's a lot more opportunity for independent journalists and smaller outlets. There's definitely a lot of public distrust about mainstream media, in some ways justified and others less so. But I think that has kind of expanded the sort of the pool of more independent smaller outlets. Some of them are terrible, but other ones are brilliant. And by virtue of their kind of independence, they can cover stories in a way that mainstream outlets cannot. So I think that's kind of an interesting development that's got a lot of positives and some negatives.
Thank you so much, Thomas. This has been a super interesting chat, from what makes Europe's tech ecosystem really interesting to paranormal grannies in Bosnia. it's been really great chatting to you, and I hope our listeners enjoyed this conversation with Thomas as much as we did. If you have any feedback on today's episode, contact the Taito team on LinkedIn or X, or comment on the video episode of this podcast on YouTube. You can also drop us an email at hello@taitopr.com. Thanks for listening and see you soon.
Following Up is a Without Borders podcast series produced by pan-European B2B tech PR and communications agency Taito. You can find every interview on YouTube and all major podcast platforms. Subscribe now so you never miss an episode.